Greetings, everyone, and welcome to The Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 70 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on Social Security right after this. You know, when you're making $50,000 a year, you're paying $7,650 in Social Security taxes. Then you pay a 17% income tax on that same $50,000. That's another $8,500. Now, you just paid an extra $1,300 by paying your tax on a tax. And that makes the real effective Social Security tax rate 17.8%, not the 15.3% that's advertised. Now, isn't that just real special? If you'd like more information about tax and status, why don't you call the law school at 417-273-4967. Help take a bite out of crime. And call and ask for my free general law CD package now. That's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Tax and status is available on compact disc for adult home education. Now, if you're online, you can go to the website georgegordon.org, click onto the email, and then send an email request for your free general law CD package, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, last time we were talking about Social Security, I showed you an article from Fortune magazine. They said Social Security is an abyss, $44 trillion, and it's growing at the rate of $1.6 trillion per year. Now, that's the combined Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare deficits that are projected into the future. That is, benefits that are promised to all of us. But when we take a look and we analyze the amount of income the government has coming in, they don't have and they are not projected to have the money to pay. Now, right now, they've got enough money to pay. But by the year 2018, they're not going to have it. And that means by the year 2018, either taxes have to go up or benefits have to go down, or we have to print more money, which creates more inflation. And that doesn't solve the problem either. It's a chain letter Ponzi scheme. In the final analysis, it can't continue on indefinitely, and the logical thing to do is to terminate it right now. Just terminate it. Now, I know that's irreligious to do that, because Social Security is the third rail of politics. But then, it's a theft proposal. It's a theft of the wages and productivity of the young people in the country, and a transfer of that wealth to the old people of the country by use of the police powers of the state. It's a violation of the 10th commandment and the 1st commandment. You shall have no other gods before me, and you shall not covet and lust after somebody else's property. The old people are saying, well, we have to be taken care of, and the young people owe it to us to take care of us. Well, excuse me. Shouldn't the old people of today have taken provisions and taken care of themselves? And somebody says, well, they're old people, and they didn't do that, so us young people have to take care of them. Okay, well, once you have taken your resources and taken care of the older generation, then how are you going to take care of yourself? And so the answer is, well, the younger generation's going to take care of us. Oh. And when this Ponzi scheme gets to such a point that it consumes more than we can produce, then who's going to take care of the old and the young? And that's the dilemma that we're facing. Because this thing is coming to an end, whether we like it or not. Whether we admit it or not. It's like It's like the jar of beans I told you about last program. I said, just take a jar, fill it full of beans. Take out two, put one back. Take out two, put one back. At some point in time, the thing's going to be empty. Social Security and Medicaid are headed in that direction. It's not going to be tomorrow. It's not going to be next year or 5 years from now, but there's a point in time when it's coming to a final conclusion. So in 1984, I could see that, and I said to myself, I think I'll get out now. I'm going to get off the Titanic here in Ireland, and I'll let the rest of you guys ride on to New York. So I got off early. And I'm simply suggesting that those of you that are still riding on the Titanic, start planning for a ride to the bottom of the ocean. Or you better figure out a way to get off this ship before it sinks. Now, you've got some time. You know, it isn't going to happen next week. But where did this idea of Social Security come from? If it's a bankrupt Ponzi scheme, why did the government get involved in it? They don't let anybody else create and operate these Ponzi schemes. Why, your state's attorney general will shut them down if they try that. Why does the federal government do it? Well, first of all, no one can believe that Social Security is a Ponzi scheme. That's because it's so big. It's what Adolf Hitler said. You know, you tell a lie over and over enough, people will believe it. And 80 million Germans will believe it. And 60 million Frenchmen will believe it. And 270 million Americans will believe it. So we're going to take a look at some numbers here, but let's take a look at some history before we get into the numbers. And we find that a fellow by the name of Townsend, Dr. Townsend's crusade, the crackpot idea that led to Social Security. Well, heaven knows, the physical science have given birth to a rich assortment of follies since the beginnings of the scientific revolution in the 17th century. From perpetual motion machines to the chimera of cold fusion in our own era, crackpot physics is nothing compared with the nutty convictions that we find in the field of economics. Now, the only trouble with this is that the scheme wouldn't lower total demand for gasoline. For instance, there was a guy came up with a scheme, and he said, here's what we'll do. We'll boycott the Exxon Corporation, and we won't buy any gasoline from them at all. And we'll spread this movement all over the United States. And when we do that and we buy our gasoline from somebody else, Exxon then, the biggest gasoline manufacturer, in order to sell their gasoline, will have to reduce their prices. That in turn will cause all of the rest of these guys to lower their prices. Sounds like a pretty good idea, doesn't it? Well, the only trouble with that kind of a scheme is that it's not going to lower the total demand for gasoline. So, if the Exxon company is facing a decline in demand for its gasoline, that would jigger its refining capacity to maximize output of its thousands and of other program or petroleum products. And other companies facing increased demand would do the opposite and make up for any shortfall by buying gasoline on the wholesale market from, guess who? Exxon. And prices would stay exactly the same. In fact, prices would probably go up. Go up. Now, this idea is unlikely to get beyond the back fence chatter of the internet, but other ideas equally devoid of economic sense have launched national movements. The free coinage of silver movement in the last decades of the 19th century. Basically, it was a disguised means of triggering inflation to benefit debt-ridden farmers. In one example. Now, it gave William Jennings Bryan the Democratic nomination or the nominee for president three times. And another is called the Townsend Plan. It was made by an obscure, elderly California doctor, one of the most famous men in the country back in the 1930s. More important, it proved instrumental in bringing into being one of the most popular federal programs in history, the Social Security Program. Francis E. Townsend was born in 1867 into an impoverished Illinois farming family. They soon moved to Nebraska, where he graduated from high school and began a varied and not notably successful career. He tried farming and selling in Kansas, land speculation in Los Angeles, and working as a laborer in Colorado. By 1899, he had enough money to enroll in the Omaha Medical College, and he graduated in 1903 at the age of 36. During World War I, he worked as an army doctor, and when he returned to South Dakota following the armistice, he became very sick with peritonitis. And to help recover his health in a gentler climate, he moved in 1919 to Long Beach, California, and there, besides practicing medicine, he dabbled in real estate. But the Depression wiped out most of his savings, and he had to take a job as assistant director of the city health office. In 1933, he lost that job when the city was forced to cut back in the face of steadily falling tax revenues, and at the age of 66, Dr. Townsend found himself both poor and out of work in the depths of the greatest economic calamity in the nation's history. There were millions of elderly people in the same boat. And Dr. Townsend suddenly had a vision as to how to help them and himself and the country as a whole. So he wrote a letter to a newspaper outlining his plan. It had the virtue of great simplicity. In its fully evolved form, the government would pay $200 a month to everyone over the age of 60 who agreed to stop working. The only proviso was that the money couldn't be saved. It had to be spent within 30 days. The plan would be paid for with a 2% federal tax on every transaction in the country. Dr. Townsend saw nothing but virtue in his plan. It would make secure the old age of everyone in the country by allowing many older people to retire. It would open up jobs for the young by giving the elderly greatly increased purchasing power. It would kickstart the economy back to prosperity. Economists, however, saw it a little bit differently. In 1933, the gross national product of the United States was $55.6 billion. But there were about 11 million people age 60 or over in the country. That meant that under the Townsend plan, the government would have to pay them an annual sum amounting to about $22 billion, almost half the gross national product, and equal to 13 times the total government's revenues. Further, the average per capita income that year was $374, and the cost of living was even much lower. $3,000 was a solidly middle-class income, yet Townsend's plan would have paid an elderly couple $4,800 a year. So the plan amounted to a massive transfer of income from the working young to the retired elderly, with very little change in net consumption. While the Townsend plan was crackpot economics, it had, not surprisingly, a very powerful appeal to the elderly. Letters poured into the Long Beach newspaper in which the suggestion first appeared. Townsend clubs sprang up all across the nation, and petitions were signed demanding the plan's implementation. Franklin Roosevelt was exquisitely sensitive, political antennae at tangle, knew that he had a problem. In January of 1934, Townsend incorporated his movement as Old Age Revolving Pensions Limited. A year and a half later, Townsend's supporters claimed that there were 7,000 Townsend clubs in operation, and some 25 million Americans had signed petitions calling for the enactment of the Townsend Plan. Townsend had to hire 95 workers just to handle the mail. Many of California's congressmen were elected with the support of the Townsendites in 1934, and one of them introduced a bill into Congress that proposed implementing Townsend's plan virtually verbatim. Townsend, of course, was not the only person attracting a following with radical ideas. Senator Huey Long with his Share the Wealth plan and Father Charles Coughlin were in their heydays at the same time. Now, although Townsend relied on an anti-establishment appeal that resembled the populist crusades of Long and Coughlin, his movement was more creative and less reliant on demonizing political and economic elites. President Roosevelt was already moving to counter the trend with what some came to be known as the Second New Deal, and its principal features outlined in his message to Congress on January the 4th, 1935, were a national works program to employ the able jobless, banking reform, increased taxes on high incomes and inheritances, and programs to guarantee security against the hazards of unemployment, old age, and illness. Although the Republicans naturally denounced the package as the very end of the American way of life, Roosevelt said that he was trying to save our system, the capitalist system, from crackpot ideas like Townsend's. Which of those he had in mind were clear. I am fighting communism. I'm fighting Huey Longism and Coughlinism and Townsendism, Roosevelt said. He put Secretary of Labor Frances Perkins, the first female cabinet member, in charge of designing the old age insurance program. Roosevelt wanted a self-finance plan that would include payments by the workers themselves. His reasoning was very simple. With the workers paying into the system, it wouldn't be a dole, and they would be gaining a property right to receive their benefits when they retired. Now, I'm going to add something right here, my little editorial piece. I'm going to underline this. Remember these words. With the workers paying into the system, it wouldn't be a dole. It wouldn't be welfare. They would be gaining a property right to receive their benefits when they retired. Remember that word, property rights. Because there are no property rights inherent in Social Security today, and there weren't any in 1935. But you know, that's the way they sold it. And the guy that sold it, in fact, the guy that actually was the architect of Social Security wasn't Frances Perkins. It was Arthur Altmaier. Arthur Altmaier was his name. He was a New Deal Democrat from Minnesota, and he came to Washington, and he was given the job of putting this together. Now, no doubt he worked hand in glove with the Secretary of Labor, Frances Perkins. I'm not denying that. But it wasn't Perkins that came up with the idea. And this idea of Social Security is the eighth plank to the Communist Manifesto, and it was originated by George Rapp in 1805. 1805, George Rapp. The concepts of Social Security, the transfer of wealth from one group to another, is a communist philosophy. It's not something that comes from God or the Bible. It isn't even something that comes from reason, logic, or common sense, either. Now, with that property right in your mind, with those taxes in there, he said, no damn politician can ever scrap my Social Security program. Well, in the end, of course, they were not called taxes, they were called contributions. And although there was nothing voluntary about these contributions or any property rights, but FDR was exactly right about the political sanctity that would grow up around what was soon called Social Security. Today it's called the third rail of politics, and Roosevelt would have preferred to have had the Social Security system be self-financing from the beginning. But Perkins explained that that would require either very high taxes and very small payouts or a postponement of any payouts for many years. Neither of these proposals was acceptable to the president, who told Perkins, we have to have it, that is, the payments, relatively soon. The Congress can't stand the pressure of the Townsend plan unless we have a real old-age insurance system in place. and paying benefits shortly. The Social Security sausage that finally emerged from the political process excluded at first farm laborers, domestic servants, and people working at establishments with fewer than 10 employees. In other words, the very people most likely to need it couldn't get it. And it wouldn't begin making payments until January of 1940, when the payments might be as low as $10 a month, and it was a far cry from Townsend's scheme to put everyone over 60 in the upper middle class. But hardly had the program become law on August the 14th, 1935, when Congress, seeing its irresistible vote-getting potential, began to expand the benefits immediately. With the passage of Social Security, Dr. Townsend's time in the spotlight ended, and his plan was soon forgotten. But because Townsend lived to be 93, he died in 1960, he lived plenty long enough to see the essence of his vision, a measure of security for every American in his old age, come true. Well, not a bad fate for a crackpot. Well, now, Dr. Townsend came up with an idea, but where did Dr. Townsend get the idea? Did he think it up himself, or were there other people that had this idea of Social Security? Well, indeed, there was. And the first guy that actually published it and put it into operation was a private entrepreneur by the name of George Rapp. The George Rapp Society was the first successful communistic and religious organization in the United States. The society was designed for profit making for some, and its formula included a controlled economy under limited liability, which is the same ingredient of our Federal Reserve today that is running the United States to this day. Now, this is the formula that has brought Admiralty inland and has barred our access to substantive common law. George Rapp founded the Harmony Society in 1805 at Harmony in Beaver County, Pennsylvania. He subsequently moved to Harmony on the Wabash in the state of Indiana, and then moved to Economy in Beaver County, Pennsylvania. The nature of this society was brought to light in the case of Schreiber v. Rapp in 1836, heard before the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania. It's worthy of note that the Harmony Society is in full operation today, and George Bush Sr. was a member of the Harmony Society. But this case, Schreiber v. Rapp, was an action brought by Jacob Schreiber, administrator of Peter Schreiber, deceased, against George Rapp and others doing business in company under the name of the Harmony Society. To sustain the action, the plaintiff proved by testimony that the Harmony Society possessed a great deal of wealth in the form of personal property, real property, and factories. It was, in fact, a pool of property. Now, one of the witnesses, Dr. Smith, who was once a member of the association, testified to wit. He said, "They intended to make money when they entered into it. It was a part of their object. I believe there were articles at Harmony, but everyone was not obliged to sign it. Equal rights, equal enjoyments, and equal profits." And Rapp said that it should not be incorporated, for that would take too much power from him. Rapp was not elected. Rapp assumed the power that Moses and Aaron had. If anyone would not do what he said, he would say, "Well, what have you to do about it? I have the power. I could crush you. All you have to do is obey." And he got worse as he got more wealthy. George Rapp was a preacher and a very persuasive one. Adam Shelley testified on behalf of the plaintiff respecting the first articles of association on the Wabash. He said that the people were directed to come in companies. One of them read it and the rest of them signed it. As to the article signed at Economy, Rapp made a long speech, and he said that anyone who would sign it would have his name written in the Lamb's Book of Life. And if they didn't sign it, their names would be blotted out, and God would ask him about it. Now, the defendants, to sustain the issue on their part, that is, George Rapp and his associates, produced in evidence the actual articles of association. And here are some of the pertinent excerpts from the articles of association of the George Rapp Harmony Association or Society. And these are the exact principles that are incorporated into the Social Security program today, which was enacted in 1935 and codified at Title 42, Section 301 through 335 in the U.S. Code. So, when you get your Social Security account, here's what you are agreeing to. The same principles, the same program, as was incorporated into the George Rapp Harmony Society. Article 1 says that we, the undersigned, for ourselves and for our heirs, executors and administrators, do hereby give, grant, and forever convey to the said George Rapp and his associates and their heirs and assigns all of our property for the benefit of the said association or community. When you join Social Security, you give all of your labor for all of your life to the United States government for 108 benefits that you're going to receive under the Social Security Act. You voluntarily sign up in a guardian-ward relationship, just like the Rapp Society, in which you forever forbear any claim to your property. Why don't you go read it for yourself? Title 42, Section 301 through Section 335, the terms and conditions, the statutory provisions of Social Security. It isn't worded in just exactly these words, but this is the net conclusion that Social Security imposes upon you. Article 2, we do further covenant and agree to, and with the said George Rapp and his associates, that we will severally submit faithfully to the laws and regulations of the said community, therefore holding ourselves bound to promote the interest and welfare of the said community, not only by the labor of our own hands, but also by that of our children, our families, and all others who now are or hereafter may be under our control. Article 3, and that we will never claim or demand either for ourselves, our children, or for anyone belonging to us directly or indirectly any compensation, any wages or reward, whatever, for our or their labor or services rendered to the said community. And you know, since 1935, Americans have never been paid. You're not paid, you're discharged. That's why Roosevelt and the New Deal took your gold coin away from you in 1933. It was to take away from you your capacity to pay your debts at law. Americans now deal in a fiat currency. You don't have money. You have credit. Article 5 says, the said George Rapp and his associates further agree to supply the undersigned severally with all the necessaries of life and to such extent as their circumstances may require. Today, George Bush calls it the safety net. Why, you wouldn't want to be left without unemployment insurance, workman's compensation, old age and survivor's benefits, now would you? You get 108 of these benefits under Social Security. Government agrees to provide you with everything you're going to need. Well, of course, maybe not in the quantities that you'd like to become accustomed to. Article 6 calls for, if any of the undersigned should withdraw from the association, then the said George Rapp and his associates agree to refund to him or them the value of all such property without interest, as he or they may have brought into the community, said value to be refunded, as the said George Rapp and his associates shall determine. You could withdraw from Social Security up until 1939, and then they said, once in, always in. Well, the court ruled for defendant George Rapp on the basis that an association for the purpose expressed is prohibited neither by statute nor by the common law. It is supposed, however, that as the intestate, this is the citation from the Supreme Court now of Pennsylvania, 1836, they said, quote, "It is supposed, however, that as the intestate had power by the articles to secede from the society and to take out whatever he had brought into it, the successor to his personal rights may exercise it as his representative. Such, however, are not the terms of the articles, and the right of accession, therefore, is intransmissible. Schreiber v. Rapp, Pennsylvania, 1836. What you pay into Social Security, you never get back. You don't get any interest on it. You pay it in, and it's transferred to somebody else directly. All of the money that's paid in this month will be paid out next month to the beneficiaries. Now, the court also stated that the law knows of no duress by advice and persuasion, and therefore there was no fraud in the inducement to sign the article. An analysis of the case reveals, 1, the complaint was brought under the jurisdiction of the common law. 2, the plaintiff lost because of the common law and constitutionally protected right to a contract. 3, under the common law, the only way to break the contract was to prove fraud. 4, according to testimony, the members of the association intended to make money when they entered into it. And the witnesses did not explain how they expected to make money under the terms of this contract. The only reasonable explanation is that they were gambling that they would be the last survivors in the association and that they would share in the distribution of the assets. And or, they expected to benefit from limited liability by sharing the losses of the association with all of the other members. In analyzing the George Rapp Association formula, it can be concluded that, 1, last survivors take all, that's called a Tontine wagering policy, 2, mutual sharing by members of any losses incurred by the association is insurance, 3, the contract contained a forfeiture clause, and members would never claim compensation upon withdrawal. Value of the property would be refunded without interest. And the right of accession of property donated to the association is intransmissible to heirs of the decedent. You know, there's no inheritance incident to Social Security. And when you withdraw, you get nothing back, and you can't get paid any interest on what you put in. 4, it was a controlled economy under the exclusive control of George Rapp and his associates. And 5, there was no accountability to the members of the association. If Schreiber had taken these facts into an admiralty court and applied the proper admiralty law to those facts, alleging fraud, he should have won his case. One additional note on George Rapp, he continued to gain affluence and prestige, and dignitaries came from all over the world to his mansion at Economy to marvel at the fantastic success of his society. He was successful because by contract he had slave labor, donations of untold wealth from members who, if they chose to withdraw before they died, could only get back the equivalent of what they had donated without interest. And if they died as a member, the property and assets donated remained in the society. Rapp, of course, owned the society. Well, George Rapp died in 1847. However, the society went on, and subsequent evidence will show that the tremendous wealth that was accumulated by this society was subsequently used to fashion a George Rapp Society on a much larger scale, with plans to ultimately encompass the world in a super state controlled and governed by mercantile interests under the law of admiralty. Today we call it the New World Order. A superstate wherein all of the property of the world and all of the people on the good ship Earth will be pledged to the benefit of this worldwide mercantile association. All right, we got to take a little break right here. Let me give you a couple of reminders. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to the website georgegordon.com. www.thelawschool.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or the staff of this network or of this radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to the website georgegordon.org or call the law school at 417-273-4967. Well, let's take a look at Social Security from the perspective of the law. How does the law see it? Well, Social Security account numbers are in reality a license to work for a corporation. You want to work for General Motors, you have to have a license. And that's because under Hale versus Hinkle, corporations don't have rights, but individuals do. So an individual must surrender those rights under the terms of a contract so that you can work for this corporation. Remember, President Bush says that what you Americans want are jobs, jobs, jobs. And if that's true, that what you want are jobs, 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 then you need a Social Security license to work for those corporations. That's the way the law sees it. That's the way the law works. Now, Social Security is voluntary. You don't have to have a Social Security account. You cannot be compelled to join Social Security, but you can't work for General Motors without a Social Security account. The law requires those corporations who do not have any rights, corporations which do not have any capacity, they have to have a Social Security account. So General Motors signs up with Social Security. General Motors has a federal tax identification number. General Motors has to perform under the terms and conditions of the law. Listen to Hale versus Hinkle. The Hale versus Hinkle was decided back in 1905. It's cited at 201 U.S. 43. And it explains to us, from the Supreme Court's point of view, how corporations and individuals differ. And in this case, the American Tobacco Company, a corporation, was subpoenaed by the IRS to produce its records and books, and the company controller claimed that the Fourth Amendment protected their records and books unless the IRS had a search warrant, and here's what the Supreme Court said about that. Conceding that the witness was an officer of the corporation under investigation and that he was entitled to assert the rights of the corporation with respect to the production of its books and papers, we are of the opinion that there is a clear distinction in this particular between an individual and a corporation, and that the latter, the corporation, has no right to refuse to submit its books and papers for an examination at the suit of the state. Corporations can't come into court and say, well, we're not going to produce these records and books. We've got constitutional rights. Corporations have no constitutional rights. But there are some people that do. And the court went on to say that the individual may stand upon his constitutional rights as a citizen. The individual is entitled to carry on his private business in his own way. The individual has power to contract, and his power to contract is unlimited. The individual owes no duty to the state or to his neighbors to divulge his business or to open his doors to an investigation, so far as it may tend to criminate him. The individual owes no such duty to the state since he receives nothing therefrom. You should underline, he receives nothing therefrom. Social Security offers you something from the public treasury. And when you receive something from the public treasury, you come under Wickard versus Filburn. It is hardly lack of due process or equal protection of the law for government to regulate that which it subsidizes. It's hardly lack of due process or equal protection for government to regulate that which it subsidizes. Have you ever wondered why it is the government constantly has their hand out trying to give you something, trying to get you to take welfare and food stamps and Social Security and unemployment insurance and marriage licenses and birth certificates and driver's licenses and business licenses, and on it goes. These are contracts. Well, they're not called contracts, they're called licenses. But a contract is an offer with an acceptance over time with consideration. So when the government offers you a marriage license over time with consideration, and you agree to it and you take it, you have a contract. I know out in California they have an animal out there called a civet cat. It's black and white, and it smells real bad. Civet cat. Well, they got another animal out there that's black and white, and it smells real bad, and they call it a skunk. Now, in law, you've got an offer with an acceptance over time with consideration, and that's called a contract. But if it's a license, then it's not a contract. Well, that's what they tell us. Well, I'm just one of those old-timey guys, and if it's black and white and stinks real bad, I call it a skunk. You can call it a civet cat if you want, but it works the same, smells real bad, looks the same. Now remember that the individual owes no such duty to the state since he receives nothing therefrom. So if you're receiving something from the state, you owe something to the state. The individual's rights are such as existed by the law of the land long antecedent to the organization of the state, and it can only be taken from him by due process of law and in accordance with the Constitution. And among his rights are a refusal to incriminate himself and the immunity of himself and his property from arrest or seizure except under a warrant of the law. Notice this word property again. An individual has a right to property. Social Security has no property rights attendant to it. I'll show you that as we progress along. Now, if you have property, your property is immune from arrest or seizure except under a warrant of the law. The individual owes nothing. The individual owes nothing to the public so long as he does not trespass upon their rights. Sounds like to me that we should be thinking more in terms of becoming individuals rather than employees or self-employed businessmen, don't you? Seems like to me that we ought to have more in the nature of property and property rights rather than franchises. You ever heard of the franchise to vote? Franchise to vote. Well, they keep telling us and hammering on us that America is a democracy and that you should exercise your voting franchise. But a franchise is a privilege. Individuals have rights and individuals own property. Going to mull that one over a little bit. And is that the way you're being treated as an individual with property who has rights? Or are you being treated as an employee with a franchise for which you have a guardian ward relationship in which the government regulates and controls you? You know, you go to work and they tell you you have to have steel-toed shoes and a hard hat and that you have to participate in Social Security and workman's compensation and all of these tax-supported benefits. Is it any wonder then that the government comes in and regulates and controls you and tells you what to wear to work, what time to come to work, how much you're going to get paid at work, minimum wage, and all the rest? That doesn't strike me as being free or freedom, does it? Now let's take a look at a corporation. This same court goes on to say in the next paragraph, they say, on the other hand, the corporation is a creature of the state. The corporation is presumed to be incorporated for the benefit of the public. The corporation receives certain special privileges and franchises and then holds those privileges and franchises subject to the laws of the state and the limitations of its charter. The corporation's powers are limited by law. Corporations can make no contracts not authorized by their charters. Corporations' rights to act as a corporation are only preserved to it so long as it obeys the laws of its creator. And there's a reserved right in the legislature to investigate its contracts and to find out whether it has exceeded its powers. Now, it would be a strange anomaly to hold that a state having chartered or created a corporation to make use of certain franchises could not, in the exercise of its sovereignty, inquire as to how those franchises had been employed and whether they had been abused, and then demand the production of the corporate books and papers for that purpose. You know, individuals don't have to keep books and records. Corporations do. So when your government requires you to fill out or file a 1040 form and to pay Social Security and income taxes, doesn't that tell you very plainly that you are not an individual, but rather you are a corporation? Now, maybe you didn't go down and get a corporate charter, but you went into the corporation and you took a job and you filled out some papers, and those papers brought you into that corporate capacity. That's the way the law works. I don't make it that way. I'm just reporting to you the way that game is being played. Now, the Social Security number is a license, and it has certain links that are connected with it. Now, it's a license to work for a corporation, and the state may require private individuals to obtain a state-created franchise, such as a license to work for it or any of its corporate creations. A corporation, which is a creature of the state, can be compelled to require a prospective employee to possess a Social Security number, which is evidence of a state-created franchise, prior to hiring that applicant. And this is because an individual has no common law right to work for a corporation. And corporations are a creature of the civil law, not the common law. And the common law does not recognize corporations created under the civil law. Corporations are juristic. They are state-created persons. And under corporate law, the creator of a corporation, the state, can demand anything that it desires from its creation, such as regulation by statute and taxation. And the state may even destroy that corporation by use of taxation. So we learn in Enoch versus Williams, cited at 370 U.S. 1, or VZ Bank versus Fenno, cited at 75 U.S. 533. Now, just as a state employee must obtain a Social Security number and then pay an income tax on the privilege of working for the state, the individual, a free man who is otherwise unenfranchised, must admit to enfranchisement in order to work for the state or for one of the state's corporations. Those applying for and receiving a Social Security number have applied for and received a privilege from government for which an excise tax can be levied. And proof of participation is the Social Security account number. Therefore, the Social Security number is a quasi-license contract to work for all of those who want to work for the state or for one of its corporations. And it has the effect of extending the state franchise to the employee. Participation in the Social Security welfare system, as well as the privilege to receive entitlements such as unemployment insurance, welfare, food stamps, aid to dependent children, and so on, are congressionally granted benefits or privileges accruing to participants, and any privilege granted by government is a proper subject of taxation. The benefits are, in effect, subsidies of certain privileges such as minimum wage or unemployment and compensation insurance and 105 other benefits, 108 total benefits provided under the Social Security program. The costs and the benefits can be levied upon such privileges as an indirect or an excise tax. We call that the income tax. Now, since the corporation is nothing more than an extension of the state, its employees can be forced to, one, voluntarily obtain a Social Security account number as a federal license to work for a corporation and franchise. You'll see that in U.S. versus Flora, cited at 362 U.S. 145. Or two, voluntarily accept and use Federal Reserve notes in payment of the consideration or just compensation of the debt arising among and between the employee, the corporation, and the federal government. Three, you can be forced to pay the federal tax debt arising from the franchise and to pay that debt in Federal Reserve notes. You can be compelled to provide information and file a return. And then file an IRS W-4 form upon employment, which is a contract of franchise and expectation and promise of payment of the tax due at the year's end. The reason that the Social Security account number operates as a franchise tax is that the payments are matched by the employer, which is a state-created corporation, resulting in reduced net tax revenue by way of deductions. The payments from the employee and the corporation go into the general fund. They do not go into a special protective fiduciary fund. And three, the expectations of the employee are addressed to receiving benefits from the general fund, which is a franchise in itself, because when we retire on Social Security, we're paid out of the general tax revenues. Social Security is not insurance. It is a social welfare scheme. So says Fleming versus Nestor, cited at 363 U.S. 603. And the Social Security account number operates as a taxable franchise. There are no property rights in Social Security, and where there are benefits or entitlements without property, there has to be a franchise. In every known court case regarding state compulsory insurance benefit programs dealing with withholding, such as unemployment compensation, accident disability insurance, and so on, corporations are involved, and the cases in effect hold that a corporation can be compelled to withhold and otherwise participate in such programs. The application and receipt of a Social Security account number by a person or individual is the admission of a jurisdiction by the IRS over the property, the interests, or the endeavors of that person or individual. The IRS 1040 form is a negotiable instrument in the form of a revivable installment note. Installments are due annually on any state-created franchise, the payment upon which is directly proportional to the extent to which the franchise is exercised as measured by the net income. As the privilege of exercising corporate franchise is that for which the state requires this excise tax, as we see in the UCA 59-13-1, which is an annual tax. The mere existence of a corporation subjects the corporation to the tax. The amount of the tax is computed according to the extent to which the franchise is exercised by and as measured by the net income derived from such use, as is explained in American Inventory Company versus Utah State Tax Commission, cited at 101 U.S. 189. Now, the excise taxes can only be applicable to corporations and enfranchised persons. You'll see that in West's Taxation Key 117 or 84 CJS 134. However, the excise tax is not applicable to persons that are not accepting these state-granted franchises. Cases represented by Hale versus Hinkle, cited at 201 U.S. 43, on page 74 show that a franchise person is regulatable and can be compelled as a matter of law to do that which his creator, the state, requires of him, but that an unenfranchised person cannot be so regulated as he receives nothing from the state. Now, we the people formed the U.S. government, and we are its creator. Its corporate charter is the U.S. Constitution. And as the government tries to regulate and protect itself from its creations, the corporations, it is doing no more than the patriots who try to regulate and protect themselves from the creation which we, the people, created, and that is our government. The U.S. government is nothing more than a corporation. Just as in the commercial world, the corporate enterprises are busily engaged in competing with private individuals for economic, social, and political power. The U.S. corporation is concerned about being gobbled up by its own corporate creatures. When an individual merges his interests with those which are corporate in nature, those interests which are otherwise exempt to a free man now become taxable. And therefore, when we become a corporate employee, those wages are taxable. And this holds true when more than one individual, a class of two or more, or a group of two or more, combine their assets or capital with intent of operating to create a gain. That group, class, or association is taxable as a corporation, even though it is not recognized as a corporation under state statutes. You don't have to have a corporate charter to be treated as a corporation. You just have to act as a corporation. Now, the word taxpayer appears in almost every code, statute, and decision. Codes and cases must relate to a taxpayer and not to a non-taxpayer, as we see in Long versus Rasmussen. This also implies that some persons may well be exempt or immune from this income tax. And they are, if you're not enfranchised. If there is an up, there must be a down, and if there is a black, there must be a white, and if there is a taxpayer, there must be a non-taxpayer. Some persons are exempt. And statutes which create rights or entitlements, such as Social Security, where none existed before at common law, should be strictly construed when determining the status of persons who are entitled to benefits and who are bound by associated duties to pay. They must get an account or pay the tax. We see that in Darnak versus Coal Company, 188 Pacific 15, and Long versus Rasmussen tells us the same thing. Persons are not subject to statutes unless clearly within their intent and wording. And acts not specifically mentioned in a statute are deemed to be outside the operation of the statute. While making so many dollars per year a requirement for filing doesn't even imply jurisdiction of the IRS over an unenfranchised individual, and for the same is not clearly expressed, as in the above cases or statutes, where penal, criminal, or quasi-criminal statutes are construed, they shall be construed against the government, including those not expressly set out. See State versus Firth, 144 Pacific 907. Well, I'm about to the end of my program. We're almost out of time. I got to give you a couple of reminders, and we'll take this up next time, talking about Social Security. Our president wants to overhaul Social Security. He wants to do something to correct its deficiencies. So I thought, well, let's take a look at Social Security and see what its deficiencies are. I'm not complaining about Social Security. I don't draw it, don't participate in it. It's not a problem to me. I'm not paying the tax. So why should I get excited about it? All right, you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. All right, there's the signal. Says time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.